Hey, ladies, we continue our study of Parashiyot HaShavua. This week we study actually two parashiyot, Parashat Vayakel Pekudeh, which is actually the last two parashiyot in the book of Shemot. After this week we finish the book and next week we start Sefer Vayikra. Vayakel Pekudeh to most people will seem very repetitive. It's actually repeating all the things we learned in the previous parashiyot of Terumah Tesaveh. For the past few weeks we've been studying all the details and the technicalities and the construction of the Mishkan. All the measurements, how they were made, what they look like, all the details. We learned about all the clothes of the Kohen Gadol, their measurements, their details, what they looked like. And now in Parashat Vayakel Pekudeh, the Torah repeats all that over again, one last time. I mean, the obvious question is there a concept in the Torah as a repeat? Is there an extra pasuk in the Torah? And our rabbis say emphatically, certainly not. There is no extra vowel in the Torah. If it's repeated a second time, there must be a reason and there must be a logic. There's not an extra dot of ink in the Torah. Everything has an interpretation and everything has a meaning. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you ladies ever saw up close the inside of a Sefer Torah. The inside of the Sefer Torah, the actual parchment where the writing is, you see on top of some of the letters, there's like little hairs that are coming out of them. On the letters Sheen and Ayin and Tet and Nun and Zayin and Gimal and Saddi, on those letters, we place on top of them what's called Tagim. Tagim are like crowns. It makes the Torah look beautiful. When you look at it, you see little hairs coming above the letters like crowns. Even those hairs have reasons. Why they placed on that letter, in that specific parashah, Rabbi Akiva was able to explain every single tag, every single crown on every single letter. So back to the point, there is no such thing as a pasuk being superfluous in the Torah. So Rav Pam Zecher Tzadik Levracha says, what can we learn from these two parashiyot that we couldn't have learned already from the previous? And he says, throughout the construction of the Mishkan, the Torah writes, Ve'asita, and you should make, talking in the future tense, and you should make this, and you should make that, Ve'asita, Ve'asita, Ve'asita. In Parashat Vayakel, there's no more Ve'asita. No more that you should do. The Torah says, Vayas. He did it. Which means it became a reality. There's a great lesson over here, he says. The lesson of these parashiyot is to follow through. How many times do people have projects and ideas and visions and goals that they set for themselves? Whether it's a spiritual goal, whether it's a physical goal, like even taking a diet. But we start off with a plan and we're going to do it. Va'asita, we're going to have this and this and that. But most people get lost between the va'asita and the vayas. And the actual coming through, the actual following through, the actual doing it. The Torah is coming to tell you, the idea to build the Mishkan was not only theoretical. It wasn't only a good idea when it was committee meetings, we'll chew, we'll build, we'll make. The greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu was he had the idea and he did it and he saw it to fruition. Unfortunately, we don't have that commitment and that consistency and persistence that Moshe Rabbeinu had. How many of us, during the high holiday season, during the month of Elul, a month before Rosh Hashanah, start to make introspection and contemplation and we're going to be better? And next year we're going to make berachot. And next year we're going to be more modest. And next year we're going to speak less lashon hara. And we're going to do more chesed. And at the time that we make these resolutions, We mean it. We're not joking. We really mean it that we want to get better. And comes Rosh Hashanah and we start to follow them in the 10 days. But somewhere around Hanukkah time, most people revert back to their old way and all their resolutions are forgotten and we settle back like a rubber band that's stretched for a while and then it lets go and goes right back to where it began. We have a lot of commitment when it comes to making resolutions. Va'asita, that's very strong. But va'yas, to actually follow through, that's the difficult part. That's why many of the gedolim, many of the greatest rabbis, whenever they would accept upon themselves resolutions and commitments, they never accepted upon themselves big things, nor did they accept it upon themselves for long durations of time. Because they knew it's hard to keep these commitments. One great rabbi accepted upon himself to read Birkat HaMazon from the Sidur. He felt that by reading it from the book, even though most people know it by heart maybe, but when you read it from the book, you get a little more concentration, you're able to zone in on the Birkat HaMazon a little better. And how long did he accept this commitment for? For only 6 months. And then after 6 months, he re-registered his commitment. This is the proper way, in order that we shouldn't fall into a depression of just constantly feeling that we commit ourselves to things and don't follow through. The message would be, accept upon yourself something small, but something for a shorter period of time, that you could say after 6 months, I did it. The Yetzer Hara loves to challenge us at the time of making the commitment. Accept upon yourself everything. No Lashon Hara, no this, no that. You feel like a big hero. But the Yetzer Hara is setting you up for the kill. He's setting you up for the down. When it comes in 6 months, Yetzer Hara says, ha, 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 you fulfilled nothing. Therefore, one must be alert in the beginning of his commitment, at the Ve'asita stage, in order that he could be successful at the Vayah stage. Torah then comes and tells us, Sheshet yamim te'aseh melacha, ubayom ha-shivi'i yihyeh lachem kodesh, Shabbat Shabbaton la-Hashem. The Torah introduces to us the law of keeping Shabbat. Cannot be overemphasized how important this law of Shemirat Shabbat is. From its punishment, you can see how severe Shabbat is. You can always judge the importance of a mitzvah by looking at the punishment. Not that we obsess ourselves with punishment. We like to serve God because it's the right thing and it's the proper thing and it's the good way of life. But we cannot be oblivious from the fact that there are punishments that are levied in the Torah. God forbid if a lady doesn't go to the mikveh, for example, the punishment is karet. Karet is from the greatest punishments that one can endure. The soul just becomes it dissolves, it evaporates, it's gone, it's karet. There's no, that's why the mitzvah of mikveh. That's why in our community, if there's one thing that the community as a whole accepts, is family purity classes to all the hatanim and kalot before they get married, because of the severity of what it means in its punishment. Shabbat, its punishment is sikila. God forbid if somebody would carry even a handkerchief or even a few pumpkin seeds in the public domain on Shabbat. He thinks he's celebrating Shabbat. It's a beautiful thing. Anything wrong with eating bizzard on Shabbat? That's the whole enjoyment. To walk on Ocean Parkway on the bicycle pad with some bizzard in your hand, chew on it, spit the shells out, phenomenal. And honoring Shabbat Gedola Mizu. It's beautiful. You think you're fulfilling the Shabbat the right way. Now, ladies, I don't make the rules. If it was up to me, I think that's phenomenal. If I'm writing the book, I say that's a mitzvah. Eat your bizzard, be happy. But unfortunately, no one consulted me. I don't make the rules. The Torah tells us it's forbidden to carry on Shabbat. Now, carrying doesn't mean only carrying a sack of potatoes or carrying some type of heavy load in the public domain. Carrying means carrying anything. It means carrying a handkerchief in order to blow your nose or carrying some pumpkin seeds. We have to be very careful for this. Baruch Hashem, our people, I truly believe, they are willing to understand things so long as it is explained to them, so long as they understand the source, so long as it's communicated in an understandable fashion. But most people, unfortunately, consider themselves Shomer Shabbat. And I believe that at heart, they are Shomer Shabbat, which is probably the first step that you have to be. They appreciate it, they love it, they want to do it. But unfortunately, education has been remiss for many years, and therefore they don't know what does it mean to be Shomer Shabbat. But if you teach them step by step, this is permissible, this is not permissible, then the people can truly step by step become Shomer. Carrying, for example, is a major issue. I don't have to tell you, you know already all the questions with Eruv and not Eruv, so you see what type of subject it is. But so long as there's no Eruv, one has to be very careful. God forbid, in the olden days, if somebody would carry on Shabbat, and you'll forgive me, I'm not trying to intimidate anybody, but the Torah tells us, they throw him off a building and stone him to death. It's a terrible punishment. For a guy carrying some visitor to Hacham, it doesn't make any sense. So it's such a punishment, it's not normal, it's irrational. Again, melacha, work, the Torah defines work, it's not work as we know it. Work is defined as spiritual work. By carrying even a child in the public domain, even though to us that's not work, to us we define that as pleasure. We define that as enjoyment. In your house, it's permissible to carry a sack of potatoes upstairs and downstairs all day long. That's permissible, hacham, that's work. How could that be permissible and this be forbidden? Explanation is the work is a spiritual work. And therefore the neshama becomes strained when these things happen. Even though physically we feel okay, but the neshama takes these type of work, takes it very, very seriously, and God forbid it puts a great blemish. Baruch Hashem, our people accept these things, and they learn these things, and they follow these things. Torah tells us, Sheshet yamin te'aseh melacha. In introducing Shabbat, it says, 6 days, your work should be done. And then on the seventh rest. It doesn't say 6 days work. It says 6 days your work should be done, as if the work is done by itself. And the rabbis learned a great lesson over here. Most people have a hard time keeping Shabbat regarding business, working on Shabbat, opening their stores on Shabbat, because they feel they're going to lose out. After all, they believe that their parnasah, their livelihood is dependent on their effort. So how could you tell a man, take off 1/7 of the week, and you're going to make the same amount of parnasah? What are you talking about? I'm taking off a seventh of the week. I'm not working. I'm sitting home eating rice and kibbeh amda. You're telling me I make the same amount of money? How could that be? So the Torah is telling you, my friend, even the 6 days that you're working, it's not you either. It's not sheshet yamin ta'aseh, not 6 days you work, 6 days te'aseh, meaning the work is going to be done on its own. Even a person that makes effort at the end of the day, I'll show you two people. They have stores right next to each other. They sell the exact product. They have the same exact price. The stores are just as admirable. Why does customers decide to walk into store A and not walk into store B? Same goods, same location, same area. Could you explain that? And they're both opening up at 9 o'clock and they're both closing at 5. Everybody's putting in the same amount of effort. So you see, it's not the effort. Borei Olam sends the parnasa. Sheshet yamin te'aseh. Even you think you're working, it's not you. Once you realize that for the 6 days it wasn't you, so therefore the seventh day you can take off. But when you think it's you for 6 days, then you have a hard time resting on the seventh day because it's me, but I'm not in the store, so it's not going to work. So the Torah goes out of its way to introduce Shabbat by giving us a philosophy on the first 6 days how it works, so it'll be much easier for the businessman to take off on Shabbat. Once the Hafetz Chaim found out of a fellow that was opening his factory on Shabbat, so he went to talk to him. And the rabbi told him that certainly by opening on Shabbat, you're going to jeopardize your whole business. He says, what are you talking about, Hacham? He says, by opening on Shabbat, I'm making more money. He says, no. The Torah tells us, Sheshet yamin te'aseh melacha, if you want business for 6 days, you better close on the seventh. That's the way he explained the Pasuk. that the Shemirah Shabbat preserves work for 6 days. But when there's no Shemirah Shabbat, you're putting in jeopardy the 6 days. And the fellow scoffed at the Hafetz Chaim and said, you're going to tell me how to run business from a pasuk of the Torah? And a few weeks later, the Bolsheviks came into Russia and they seized his property and they seized his factory and they closed them down. And he came back to the Hafetz Chaim and says, you're 100% right. My business is dependent on a pasuk of the Torah. Those that keep Shabbat are preserving 6 days of work. But those that do not fulfill Shabbat, God forbid, they're jeopardizing the other 6 days. There is an interesting custom that some people have, and it's a good custom to take upon yourself, to eat fish on Shabbat. The Gemara says, or the rabbis say, Kol ha'ochel dag, v'yom dag, nitzol mi dag. Anybody that eats dag, fish, on the day of dag, is saved from dag. What does this mean? Dalit gimal, dalit equals 4 numerically, and gimal equals 3. So the numerical value of dag is 7. So it says, kol ha'ochel dag beyom dag, whoever eats fish on the day of dag, meaning on the 7th day, nitzol mi dag, is saved from dag. Dag also stands for 2 words. Din gehinam. Dag. So whoever eats fish, kol ha'ochel dag, beyom dag, on the 7th day, nitzol mi dag, is saved from din gehinam. Why? What is this concept of eating fish on Shabbat? So I once heard an explanation that's quite beautiful. The rabbi explained, if you ever noticed, which you probably didn't, I also didn't notice, the way a fish eats, the big fish swims in the ocean. And he's a predator. He's looking to catch small fish to eat them. But very interesting, the big fish never catches the small fish by the tail. Which you think that's what he's doing. He's chasing it. You think he catches it by the tail. How does the big fish eat? When he finally relaxes and opens his mouth to yawn, the small fish swim right in his mouth head first. The fact. So if you open up, if you split the belly of a fish, you'll see that the fish that entered head first. You see, that's the way it's aligned in its stomach. There's a great lesson to that. God is telling you, the fish thinks that he's in control of supporting himself. And the Torah tells us, that when the fish makes his effort, wherever he's running and going, he's never successful. But at the end of the day, when he puts his hands up to God and says, God, I have nothing. God says, you don't have to do anything. The fish come right in his mouth. So for the way the fish sustain themselves teach us that parnasah is from God. The fish teach us that lesson, that it's not about your effort. It's not about your work. It's about God. Therefore, on Shabbat, the businessman that takes off for work, he's concerned. What's going to be? My money, my business, parnasah. So he eats fish on Shabbat in order to remind him that the parnasah doesn't come from our efforts and our work. Just like the fish is sustained automatically by God bringing smaller fish swimming right into its mouth in order to feed itself. That's one of the reasons why we eat fish on Shabbat. Of course, there are other reasons brought down, but that could suffice for our purposes. Lo tevaru esh b'chol moshpotechem b'yom ha-Shabbat. Torah then tells us, it's forbidden to light a fire on Shabbat. It's worth it to talk a little about this pasuk. Of course, we don't have to tell these ladies over here, Nashim Tzadkaniyot, about turning on fires or turning on lights. In the olden days in our community, there was a great misconception. People used to turn channels on Shabbat. People shouldn't be turning channels even during the week. But all the more so on Shabbat to be turning channels. You know, if the television is on already and all we're doing is moving. So many different isurim. Again, 20 years ago in our community, this was accepted. This was normal. But look how far our community came. Today we laugh about it. I believe the same thing will be about carrying on Shabbat and all the other things. Today we're a little apprehensive about it because it's a new thing. We're not used to it. But in 20 years from now, it's a slow process. rabbis will come to give classes and they'll say, remember 20 years ago people used to roll strollers on Ocean Parkway on Shabbat, and it was a ha 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 ha. You remember we used to do that? How silly were we? What were we thinking? So it's a slow process like that case over there. In any event, there's a interesting statement from one of the Rishonim, Rabbeinu Nisim. Rabbeinu Nisim writes that a person should make every effort on Shabbat afternoon, to eat hot food. To eat at least one hot dish. And then he goes and says, and if somebody doesn't eat at least one hot dish on Shabbat, we have to suspect that maybe he was influenced by the group called the Tzidukim and the Karaim. Who are the Tzidukim and who are these Karaim? What type of people are these? Tzidukim and Karaim were purists. What is a purist? They read the Torah in its most literal interpretation. They don't read Gemara, they don't read Rashi, they don't read Midrash. They read the text as the text is written. No more, no less. For example, I once walked into a fellow's house here in New York, and I noticed something very strange that I never saw before. He had his talet hanging on the wall. I never saw such a thing. I went to my rabbis. I said, Hakam, is there such a thing to hang a talet on the wall? In a kuracha maybe, on your back certainly, but on the wall? And the rabbis told me that in the Torah it says about the sisit, ur'item oto, and you shall see the sisit. So how did these Siddukim interpret that? You should see it, like a picture. So they hang it on their wall, so when you walk in you see it. And we don't interpret it like that. We interpret that pasuk according to Hachamim that you should wear it in the day when it's visible, as opposed to wearing it at night when it's dark. They have a whole different explanation. He says this fellow definitely was influenced from Tzeduki philosophy. Another thing, Tzedukim, when they put on tefillin in the morning, they wear the tefillin in between their eyes, right above their nose, because the Torah says clearly, Utotafot ben enecha, that the tefillin should be between your eyes. That's the most literal interpretation. We don't interpret it like that. We mean between the eyes, meaning centered, but on the hairline. In the center of the hairline, in between the eyes. So you see, it's Siddukhi will wear it that way, and he'll bring a proof. He'll say, look, the pasuk says it. And they go through the whole Torah like that, distorting every single pasuk. It's like they have their, it's not like, it is, they have their own religion. It's just based on Pesukim in the Bible. One of the things they misconstrued was this Pasuk of Lo Tevaru Esh Bechol Moshmotechem Beyom HaShabbat. The Torah says, you cannot have a fire in your house on Shabbat. So they held, you have to sit in the dark. They would not light Friday night candles. They would shut the fires on the ovens before Shabbat. And they would not have anything, no semblance of light. Because the Torah says you cannot have a light on Shabbat. We interpret it, no, it means you can't light it on Shabbat. But if it's lit from before Shabbat, certainly you could keep it on. If you turn the lights on before Shabbat, on the contrary, we're supposed to light it on Shabbat. So they misinterpreted. So what happened? If you went to a Tziduki's house for Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon lunch, you never were served hot food. Because they never had the ovens on. They weren't allowed to have it according to their thing. So the rabbis tell us, anybody that eats cold food on Shabbat, you have to be careful. That's Siddukim behavior. Therefore they say you have to go out of your way to make sure, to show that you're a loyal Torah Jew with the right interpretations, to eat something hot. I remember once I was away with Rabbi Diamond on a Ilan seminar school with the yeshiva, and it was on Shabbat, and it seems something happened with the ovens in the hotel on Friday night after dinner, that the ovens went out, so they were goyim and not allowed to relight the ovens. We had a problem. So I remember all the rabbis on Shabbat morning were all concerned about this dilemma: where are we going to get hot food in order to fulfill the mitzvah? And I never forget, all the Hakamim went to the urn over there where the water was boiling at least, and they made all themselves had a cup of coffee. And I asked them, what's are you having the coffee for what purpose? Because you want coffee? No, you have to have something hot on Shabbat. At least if we could fulfill it with a cup of coffee or a hot cup of tea. So you see over here how serious it is. Unfortunately today, in modern society, Shabbat, Friday night dinner in our community would probably be the highlight of the meals. And as the Shabbat progresses, the meals get subsequently less. Shabbat afternoon less, and Seudah Shlishit, of course, worse. But it's the opposite. According to the Halakha, it's supposed to go progressively greater, being Shabbat afternoon lunch the highlight. I am not saying by no means that is it mandatory to eat meat on Shabbat. It is definitely not mandatory to eat meat on Shabbat. Shabbat afternoon lunch. Definitely not. The Torah says you have to enjoy Shabbat. Whatever gives you enjoyment. If a person gets enjoyment from eating katsonet, so that's his enjoyment. But the point is, there should be hot food. Something should be hot. One should not minimize the Shabbat afternoon lunch with basic tuna fish or egg salad and potato salad and avocado. That's all it becomes. As if it's a, besides the fact it takes away from the kavod of the Shabbat when we have instead of having a formal meal, just a discussion for another time. Shabbat's supposed to have a little formality to it. When you have those type of meals, it takes away from the importance of the day. But I'm talking from a halachic standpoint, somewhere in the Seudah, and I'm not talking about a hot cup of coffee or tea either, somewhere in the Seudah, one should try to make with the blech and whatever the laws are, you learn them, to have some type of hot food. There's another lesson to learn from this pasuk. Do not make a fire in your domain on Shabbat. The rabbis learned from here to be careful not to get angry on Shabbat. When a person gets angry, he becomes heated. The internal fire starts to burn. And Shabbat is a very opportune time for people to get angry. Because people are all home. People are on top of each other. People are making a mess. So therefore, it's very prone for the lady to lose her temper, the children, the husband, etc., etc. Therefore, the Torah reminds you, Lo tevaru esh b'chol moshpotechem b'yom ha-Shabbat. Do not get angry. Do not heat yourself up on Shabbat. Be careful. Do not fall into that trap. But if we're mentioning this already, it'd be important to say also, one of the tactics of the Yetzer Hara is not only to anger us on Shabbat, but even more so on Erev Shabbat. Friday afternoon would probably be the most hectic time of the entire week. I'm talking from about an hour or an hour and a half before candlelighting, and as you get closer, of course, it gets more severe, becomes a very hectic time. Of course, people have to shower, and people have to get ready, and the cleaners, and picking up, and food, and doing, and be very careful, the Ben Ish Chai says. Know that you're being set up on Friday by the Yetzer Hara to get angry. The Yetzer Hara will do anything in order to create a little havoc in the house, in order to ruin the Shabbat, in order that everybody will come to Friday night table upset, not talking to each other, angry. That's done on purpose. So he says, how smart are we that we know his tactic? Thank God, over years of experience, we were able to figure out this tactic, this strategy of the Yetzer Hara. So the next time when Friday afternoon something comes up, the fellow's putting on his shirt right before Shabbat, he realizes he's missing a button. It's a very common occurrence. You could wear shirts every single day of the week, change your shirt 3 times, there's always buttons. The one you take for Shabbat, for some reason the button is missing. Know that that's the Yetzer Hara. That's a test, that he's trying to get you upset, yell at your wife, how come you didn't fix it, how come you didn't do it, etc., etc. Lo tevaru esh b'chol moshpotechem b'yom ha-Shabbat. Pasuk Kaf Aleph in Vayakel writes, Vayav or Chabet,
Vayavohu anashim al anashim kol nedivle vevi'u.
The rabbis tell us that when it came to donating the money for the Mishkan, when it came to giving the money, the ladies were actually more eager than the men. The men were a little hesitant in making these donations, but the ladies came very diligently and with great speed and zealousness, and they gave of their jewelry and they gave of their money very, very easily for the construction of the Mishkan. The Torah goes out of its way and says the ladies were more generous in donating for the Mishkan than the men themselves. And God rewarded them. How did God reward the ladies? He gave them 12 days a year to be celebrated as a holiday. Which 12 days were that? Rosh Chodeshim. Every Rosh Chodesh, Halakha brings down, it's proper for the lady to refrain from doing hard work, even though it's not mandatory. But on Rosh Chodesh day, it's a happy day for everybody. But specifically for the ladies, God designated Rosh Chodesh for them. Some righteous ladies don't do laundry on Rosh Chodesh. Some ladies are very right, they don't do laundry all month. But we're talking about the ladies that don't do it on Rosh Chodesh because of this gift. And they don't sew, they don't needlepoint. Again, it's not halakha. By no means is this halakha. It's a nice practice that the rabbis taught. It was a gift for them. God rewarded them by giving them the day of Rosh Chodesh. So one of the rabbis asked, what's the connection? I mean, the ladies are flattered that they received this holiday, Rosh Chodesh. But what's the connection? Because they were generous in giving money for the Mishkan, so they get to celebrate Rosh Chodesh. What's the connection between the two? Our rabbis tell us in Gemara, Bizchut Nashim Tzadkaniyot Nigalu Avotenu Mimisrayim, that it was in the merit of the righteous ladies that our forefathers were redeemed from Egypt. The ladies again took a major role in the redemption. How? The men, of course, were slaves. They were very down. They were very depressed. No man in his right mind was thinking to bring more children into the world. For what purpose to bring children into a world of bondage? Why do our children have to suffer by the hands of the oppressing Egyptians, Paro, like we're suffering? So they concluded, the men, we're not going to have any more children. For what purpose? The ladies, however, had tremendous betachon. They had tremendous faith that there's going to be a redemption. And if we don't have children, there's not going to be a next generation to be redeemed. And therefore, we have to see to it that Klal Yisrael perpetuates and there's a future. So what did they do? The rabbis tell us that they took special mirrors. A mirror that they had. And they used to go look at themselves in the mirror and used to make themselves up. They used to make themselves up to look pretty. And they used to go out to the fields where their husbands were working, and they used to give them something to eat and give them some hot water, and they used to talk to them and give them strength and bitachon. And the husband saw his wife look so pretty, so beautiful, and they ended up having many children. But the children only came as a result of the ladies' strength and bitachon, that they were able to pick up their husbands from the depression that they suffered in Mitzrayim. So yes, indeed, the Ge'ula comes on the part of the righteous ladies. History repeated itself. When the Jewish people worshipped the Egel, the golden calf that we talked about last week, who was behind the Egel? The men were behind the Egel. As a matter of fact, when the men came to the ladies to ask them, please give us your jewelry, give us your earrings in order to make an egel, the lady said, nothing doing, we want to have no part of this egel. And the men went and took their own earrings off and donated. So again, the ladies had tremendous amount of bitachon. And the men constructed the egel, and then God came along and said, what did you do? You made a avon, you made a sin, what kind of business is this? And God got so angry at the Jewish people after the egel, God said, I cannot have the same relationship as we've had before the Egel. The Egel has destroyed the relationship
forever.
Until then, God used to rest amongst the people, amongst all the people, everywhere. Now God said no more. Now build me a Mishkan, and I'm only going to rest in that specific area. No longer am I going to be spread out amongst the camp.
As a result of the Mishkan, we lost a lot of divine presence of Hashem.
And the men were down again. When it came to collecting for the Mishkan, the men did not have... they didn't have what it takes to give like the ladies did. Because the men felt, it's our fault that we need a Mishkan. We're to blame that we need a Mishkan. We were so zealous in building and doing, and now look, we caused us to limit the Shekhinah. So again, it was the ladies that stepped up when their husbands were down and had a hard time coming to the reality that a Mishkan is a necessity. The ladies said, no, it has to be built. It's what God wants. And they went and told the husbands, come on, we have to give. And they themselves went in a sign of an example, and they gave. God says, because of your undaunting faith, ladies, both in Egypt, when it came to looking in the mirrors, incidentally, those mirrors were very holy, the rabbis tell us. When God built the Mishkan, God told Moshe, collect all the silver from those mirrors and build the sink of the Mishkan. The sink of the Mishkan, where Aharon used to wash his hands every day, was made from those holy mirrors. You'd think a mirror's vanity. We're going to build a Mishkan, a house of God, from mirrors? It's not a holy thing. And God says, no. And the lady getting beautiful for her husband in Egypt, that's holy. Shalom bayit. Use those for the sink of the Mishkan. But in any event, the reward for the ladies bitachon was what? It was Chodesh. Because our Rosh Chodesh, our years, our months, are based on the moon. You know about the moon cycle. The moon waxes and wanes. The moon, the beginning of the month starts off very small. By the middle of the month, it's a full moon. And then towards the end of the month, it gets smaller again. It constantly gets bigger and constantly gets smaller. The Torah was telling us that the ladies had tremendous strength even when their husbands were down. Even though their husbands were down, because that's the cycle of humanity. People have their ups, they have their downs, like the market. Sometimes it's high, sometimes it's low. There's no such thing as a steady line. But the ladies had that consistency. The ladies had that straightness. When the men were down in Egypt, the ladies were there to pick them up. When the men were down at the Mishkan, the ladies were there to pick them up. Hence, they get to celebrate Rosh Chodesh, which exemplifies that same concept. The moon going up and going down, going up and going down, getting big and small, to show that the ladies were there, even at the time that Klal Yisrael, the men, were weak. Perashat Pekudei, will just say one chidush in the beginning of the Perashah. Torah tells us, Ele pikudei ha-mishkan, mishkan ha-edut. Right away, a double language. It says, this is the reckonings of the tabernacle. Mishkan, mishkan. Why would it say the same word in a row? There's only one mishkan. What does it mean, Ele pikudei ha-mishkan, mishkan? So the rabbis tell us, mishkan, mishkan is talking about the two batei mikdash that we had. Besides the Mishkan, we had a temple. We had two temples. Why would the temple be called the Mishkan? It's not a Mishkan. Mishkan is a temporary structure. The temple is a house. The rabbis explained that the word Mishkan can also be read Mashkon. Mashkon is a collateral. The two Batim Mikdash were actually collaterals that when God had to punish us, instead of punishing us, He mortgaged the Beit HaMikdash and took it back. Thank God we had a Beit HaMikdash. Because if we didn't have a Beit HaMikdash, God would have had to take retribution from our people. So the Torah says, Mishkan, Mishkan. There were two collaterals. The two houses, the two Beit HaMikdash. There's a famous mashal given by Rabbi Yaakov Medubna. He says, one time the king, he was making a wedding. he was making a wedding for his son. And he hired the best caterer and the best musicians and the best tapestries. And he made a garden wedding, the most beautiful canopy. Everything was set up. Money was not an option, obviously. And on the day of the wedding, he found out that his son had committed a terrible crime. And the king went crazy. The king started flipping over all the buffet tables. And he started breaking all the chairs. And he started ripping all the flowers. And he started going on a tirade, destroying all the thousands and millions of dollars of work. One man went crazy. He destroyed it with his own hands. And then he started going to the orchestra and breaking all their instruments. And finally, one violinist that was hiding under the table, after the king finally settled down, the violinist came out with his violin and started serenading the king. And the king says, "You Rasha, don't you see how angry, don't you see how upset, what in the world? Can you be happy that you're playing music?" So the fellow says, "I'm happy, thank God the king's son was not here. Because if the king's son was here, all this anger would have been vented out on your kid. If you would have ripped your kid into pieces like you did to this buffet, you can't bring your son back. This buffet you can bring back, you're a rich man. Tomorrow you'll call the caterer again, he'll bring another buffet prettier, you'll call the florist again. This is replaceable. Baruch Hashem, your son wasn't around to be the victim of your anger." And that's exactly the way we look at the Beit HaMikdash. Even though we lost two Beit HaMikdash, there is a positive way of looking at that. Thank God that God took his anger out on sticks and stones. Thank God he took his anger out on a building. Thank God there was a building there that was able to be mortgaged. Because if there was no building, God forbid, the retribution would have to be taken from Am Yisrael. Therefore, it says, Ele Pikudam Mishkan Mishkan, that the two Beit HaMikdash were actually a benefit from us, not only when we had them, but even when they were taken away, they actually preserved the continuity of Klal Yisrael. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.